I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Derek.
And I'm Ray.
I'm Alex Reed.
Welcome back to another episode of
Mostly Lit.
Welcome to Mostly Lit. Welcome to this special mini-sode. That is a terrible word. I'm so sorry. Of Mostly Lit. With us behind the scenes at the Times and Sunday Times Cheltenham Literature Festival, where we attended a few weeks ago as the first podcast in residence for the festival. How did you guys find it?
Oh, the festival was great.
Yeah.
Loads of wind.
Girl.
I don't understand, but...
the tent nearly blew off.
Yeah, there's so many times the tent nearly just flew off when we were trying to talk.
Remember we were at a colour event?
Yeah.
And it's like the ancestors were coming, boys. They were like coming. Rattled.
Because he was rattling a whole lot of people in the crowd.
When we talked to Matt Haig, he dropped a one-liner and then the door blew open.
Literally, oh my God.
The door blew open.
The ancestors were strong
yeah.
in that place. But yeah, it was good.
They turned out for us.
It was good, you know, loads of books, obviously.
Yeah.
Loads of people.
Loads of wine.
Loads of wine.
Free wine.
Loads of people in residence. Loads of people just there.
It was just so cool to see people that we talk about just like standing next to us or like sitting down. You're like, oh shit, that's
fam,
that
I bumped
person.
Into Richard Curtis. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah,
I didn't even say sorry because I was so nervous.
No, I remember like I was standing in the queue to get some food. Not standing in the queue, I was standing aside waiting for the waitress to give me something.
Yeah.
And he was behind me. He's like, are you in the queue? And I'm like, no, I'm just waiting for the waitress. He's like, oh, so you're literally just standing here. And I was looking at him like, you know what? Because you wrote Love Actually,
Love Actually,
or
Notting Hill.
Love Actually. Or the, you know what I mean? Because you wrote that, it's cool, isn't it?
It's cool.
Like, it's fine.
I can give you this.
I'm gonna shake off that tone. It's fine. But otherwise, it was really weird being in that space. So, but yeah, it was really good. So shout out to the festival.
Yeah, and what events did you guys get up to? Like,
oh yeah,
doing?
So did the,
I did
turning books into your passion or passion in digital space, something like that, with Simon Savage who does Savage Reads YouTube, and Jen Campbell who does her YouTube channel, and that was chaired by Sarah Shafi, and that was really interesting. It was really interesting. It was really dope. Everybody had a lot to say about the books they read when they grew up, when they're growing up, etc.
I'm kind of gutted I didn't do one now.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah,
it was fun.
I'm kind of gutted.
Yeah.
But I know Ray won though. Anyway. I probably wouldn't have won.
Yeah.
I won't even lie, I probably wouldn't have won. Did you use any of the material I gave you?
I don't remember.
So Ray did.
I actually don't remember.
Ray did a panel.
Oh my God.
Yes, I did the a panel, the Cheltenham Man Booker panel, which essentially there was a series of books chosen, published in the year 1958, and you had to defend the book or champion the book that you would have liked to win should the Man Booker have existed in 1958. And I had to champion Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart. And
light work. She made light work of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fantastic. It was really great. There was a lot of crowd. There's a crowd of very older people.
It's very old. Very old. It was a mature crowd.
Yes. We're not ageists. Yes, we do have a pensioner here with us, so we can't be ageists.
Who's she talking about? I know she ain't talking about me.
She ain't talking about my spirit. She's talking about Return to Sender.
But yeah, so that was really fun. And I got to reread things. Well, I remember when I was rereading it, and at the end, and I was sat with you before planning it, and I was
she was proper going in, like, she had all her notes,
so
everything.
Excited. I was like, shit, like, this ending is dope.
You actually got the easiest book to do.
Yeah.
Like, because the other books are just absolute pants.
I mean,
Breakfast at Tiffany's easily ripped apart.
Yeah. Oh, the what was
Our
the
Man
name?
In
the
Havana one, easily ripped
man,
apart.
Yeah, that was quite easy to rip apart. But the bell was hard because people were really like,
because
oh,
Iris,
man, the bell.
Yeah, because Iris Murdoch can write.
Yeah.
She can write. Mm. And she's a philosopher as well. So her books are full of ideas.
I think maybe I should read more of her stuff.
You should read Under the Net.
I've got that on my
There is
shelf.
This heaviness that I, you know, like Zadie Smith, I haven't read her work, but people just talk about her so much and there's just so much description and shit. That it's kind of like, I don't want to read her stuff because it's just so heavy.
No, but you'll definitely like, you read Under the Net and then read The Sea, which she actually won the Man Booker
for. I've got that as well.
Yeah.
I've got all of that.
Okay, so.
Yeah, because I asked Penguin to send you the books. Yeah, exactly.
So we need to read those.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Anyway, so for our first, like, kind of behind the scenes look, we spoke to a man like Matt Haig. about reasons to stay alive, how to stop time, notes on a nervous planet. So have a listen to that.
Okay. Welcome, Matt.
Hello.
I'm here with Matt Haig at the moment. How's everything going, Matt?
It's really good. I mean, it's incredibly windy today. Yeah. So I did an event, a panel event in quite a small tent, and it felt like it was, we were going to do the whole Wizard of Oz and just go up in the... whirlwind, but we're still in Kansas.
Dorothy.
So yeah. It's fun.
Yeah, it's quite frightening as well. I just had to bite a tree outside. It was just kind of like,
yeah, I know. But otherwise, generally good.
Yeah.
What's a British book festival without a bit of wind?
No, exactly. Wind, yeah. Right? And a marquee flapping.
Yeah, very picturesque. Yeah.
So how was your panel?
It was good. I've got, my main event is in about 40 minutes' time, but the panel was nice. It was Scarlett Curtis has written a book called Feminists Don't Wear Pink, but it wasn't about that. It was about the books that had saved your life. Mm. So I was talking about books that had saved
What's the book that saved your life?
There was no one book. I was really rubbish because I was really trying to think and try and give an honest answer. But when I was ill, when I was 24, I found it really hard to read. Yeah. So what I used to read was, I had this old book of quotations. It was like a Collins concise dictionary of quotations. And just like concentrating on the line was quite hard because I had like full-blown panic disorder and my head was at 10,000 miles an hour.
Yeah. Okay.
But that was sort of like a gym for the mind because I was sort of like focusing on each sentence. And I know people get really snobby about inspirational quotes and stuff.
Yeah.
But for me, I know you love them. You're well into it. But well, a little bit of optimism just at the right time. If it's authentic, if it's from a real place, definitely can change your perspective on stuff.
So at what point were you then able to read entire novels?
I was reading because I was back in my childhood bedroom, so a lot of the books I had were like children's books, like really children's books, like Winnie the Pooh. So it was almost like learning to read again. And I was reading things, there was a book called The Outsiders, which I read. It was things I was very familiar with that I'd read as a teenager or even younger. And I don't know, when you're stuck in a moment in life, when you're in a sort of horrible, traumatic period of your life, you desperately want to read sort of like proper stories, capital S, with beginnings, middles and ends, And I was, before I'd had my breakdown, I'd become this kind of pretentious reader because at university, we're almost taught to be like suspicious of like story and plot and those old-fashioned things. And all I wanted then was almost like these children's books of like characters changing. Because when you're stuck in a moment, you want a character to change or transform because you want to believe in change for yourself. So it becomes almost like a religion of story.
Yes.
And so, it was a lot of kids' books. I was a bit of a mess for a few years. I was full-blown agoraphobic. So even leaving the house wasn't that good. We're in a sort of small town which culturally was sort of dead. We had no bookshop, nothing, and I was this agoraphobic person, so I was literally stuck with the books I had on my bedroom shelf.
Nice. Okay, so I have a question with regard to How to Stop Time. I read it, I think, maybe 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
And there was a point where you described how the Albers, when you've lived for a very long time,
for our listeners, what are Albers?
Albers is short for albatross, and because in the olden days they basically believed falsely that albatrosses were the most long-lived animals. Mm. It's not actually true, they lived to about 60-70, like a bit younger than humans, but so Albers is the name of people with this made-up condition called anageria, where you age super slowly. So you're not immortal, you're going to die, but it's like you'll have 800 years.
Yeah. I like that.
So, but then in an Albers time, they get to this point where time becomes, how do I put it, they almost know what's going to happen. They have this point where they can see the past, but also can see the future. And so when you set this point, I was like, whoa.
I like this. I've never been asked about this before. But this is true.
So when I wanted to ask, how did you get that concept? Because I thought that was a little profound in a way, because if you live for so long, you almost see the change in events and the repetition of history.
Yes.
And it isn't so out of the world or out of scope for you to kind of preempt what is going to happen to other people and to yourself. But so how did this concept come to you?
I don't know. I mean, I'm quite into science. I was someone who's rubbish at science at school, like F and GCSE rubbish, you know, proper rubbish.
Oh, wow.
And really bad. I think I was an hour late for my science GCSE. And I was almost proud of that. I'm not science. And and then I realised, actually, I am into science. I just had some really not very good science teachers and stuff. But, I love the idea that, you know, the whole universe in a grain of sand. If you understand something tiny, like little grain in this table here, you'll understand the whole universe of information in there that can explain everything. And I thought, you know, that's what we do with sort of physical space. But what if, like, you literally take a moment of time and then you can understand, you know, like, because we can't literally see or know the future, but if you totally had 100% understanding of any moment, you'd probably understand all the moments. And if you lived for a long time, you would have such a different understanding of time. And so it came from that. And I feel like also it's a mental illness thing, because obviously mental illness is a bad thing and anxiety is a bad thing, but there's a moment when you're sort of recovering from anxiety disorder where you feel like more alert and in tune with everything, and it's not a wholly negative feeling, because you know you're on a sort of uphill. It's kind of a fragile feeling, but you're sort of alert to everything, and very alert. And I think I was thinking about that, imagining. I've never had the actual feeling where I can sort of see into the future, but you know,
it was just described really well, so I was like, that's incredible. That whole concept, the way you captured.
I'm glad you mentioned that. No one's ever mentioned that. Thank you.
So in Notes on a Nervous Planet, you speak a lot about the way we interact and use social media.
True.
I just wanted to know what you're like,
for
listeners, like what kind of techniques or things you use to kind of help yourself in social media.
I suppose I'm a bit of a hypocrite, really, because I use it a lot. But I'm definitely not wagging my fingers and telling anyone off for using social media. There's a million amazing, beautiful, wonderful things about the internet. It's great for social causes. It's great. If I'd been ill in 1999 and I'd have been able to go online and actually find someone, I felt like I was the only person in the world experiencing that thing. It's great for shared experiences. It's great for feeling less alone. I feel like they're about to be blown away. It's all good. October weather. Yeah, and so wonderful things about it, but I think like none of us are really aware of it as a health issue. I think it's like ice cream. No one would want to be told, oh, you can't eat ice cream, but we'd kind of know if we sat on a Saturday morning just having ice cream for 6 hours, just having the Ben and Jerry's, would be a health consequence. But we sort of scroll through our Instagram and news and Twitter and everything else and emails and messages for hours on end, and it doesn't make us feel better at the end of it. You know, I feel like when I can use social media in a way that makes me happy, where you just sort of go on, you tweet something, you share something, you contact someone, and then you sort of walk away. Yeah, but it's that out. Endless scrolling, isn't it?
And you don't even have purpose, you just go on it to scroll, yeah.
And you can, especially on Twitter, you can find something to be offended by and have your day ruined within like 5 minutes.
Yes, definitely. It was so funny. The other day, me and Derek were talking, and he was like talking about something that had happened on Twitter. Like, there was a piece of news that had come from there. And I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't, because I log in, retweet stuff, and log back out.
Yeah, no, it's a good way to
like,
go.
Oh, it's so annoying because you're not going to have any context for anything that I'm going to ask you.
I think we have a conversation.
And I'm like, I don't know. I'm not on there, you know what I mean? But I find myself, like, I feel a lot more happier just being able to control what I take in and what I don't take in. And obviously noting about who you follow and kind of what you tweet about or post on Instagram.
So you don't need to use any apps for that? That's just the natural thing you can
do? Yeah, so what I had to do was, it felt like a whole kind of rehab or like process. I had to deactivate and then log out. But otherwise, I had to start managing it myself and figuring out ways to kind of post things without actually going on.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's why I like Nuts in the Never's Planet. It's really, really insightful.
I want to take it back a bit further than obviously Reasons to Stay Alive and talk about the humans.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to ask, basically, there's a lot of insight in humans, kind of things that you read and you're kind of like, oh yeah, that's very true. Like, why? How have we never noticed this before? How have we never commented on this before? I want to ask, did that insight come from you being in a bad place at a particular time and it actually having to analyse who you are and who people are?
I think so. I think that feeling of looking like you're, inverted commas, normally healthy and you're sort of a person in the world, but feeling like there's a whole planet of stuff going on in your mind was definitely, you know, that's definitely a mental illness thing where, you know, it's not, I mean, not in every case, obviously there's certain sort of symptoms of mental illness that make you visible or there's certain conditions that make you visible, but generally in my experience, no one would know what was going on inside my head. So you do kind of feel like a bit of an alien because you feel like you're inhabiting a different body because no one, it's like, why can't anyone see this stuff? You know, I mean, it's such pain and no one can see it. And so there's that kind of thing. And although that is horrible to go through, a sort of survival technique to me, it was almost like having, it's almost like black comedy. You know, it's like a fish out of water, sort of like strangely funny, but not in a cheer you up kind of way, but because you're an outsider but no one knows you're an outsider, there's a lot of sort of comedy there. So for instance, like at home, my mum would be talking about I should be talking about losing the car keys or something, and like you'd feel like your head's on fire and you're thinking, why can't you see my head's on fire, and you're just talking and worrying about everyday stuff. So that sort of stuff, and then you start to realise everything and everyone seems weird. So you start to see human beings as what we are, as a species. And like, so I was doing like a David Attenborough in my head where, you know, I almost having a narrator about, you know, and so I had the idea for a book where just the most mundane things, like people at home just having breakfast or whatever, but seeing it as David Attenborough sees a sea lion, but what, you know, watching us and watching that perspective, because I think it's a nice way into a novel when you're sort of like you've got writer's block or something, to imagine being outside a situation, because sometimes if your head's right next to the canvas you can't see it properly, so you need to take a big step back.
We are actually
flying away here.
God has spoken.
Open the doors. This is definitely a force 10, force 11 storm.
Thank you so much for coming.
Oh no, thank you. Thanks guys. I love your podcast.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, anyway, hope you guys enjoyed that, you know. You could hear us battling with the wind.
So who was next?
So we also spoke to
the lovely
my babes. I absolutely love this woman. She's incredible.
I love her. She's got such a good energy.
She's so sweet,
she's
man.
She's just a flower, you know? Just strong, proud, beautiful, smells good, calm and everything. So yeah, we spoke to Ayobami Adebayo, who the author of
Stay With Me.
And she was incredible, as always. And we also spoke to Diana Evans, and they were on a panel together. But let's first hear what my babes had to say. We really pressed her on the books that she was, what she's writing next. I was like, sis, you have to tell us. But yeah, here's what she had to say.
I was so excited to know that we have Ayo Bami in the building.
Yeah.
It's the first time I'm meeting Ayo Bami because I was working.
Yeah. Derek's not with us.
And Derek's not with us. So
we're so sorry.
Like you only get two of us at a time.
Yeah, you don't get the full crew.
But anyway, how are you finding the festival?
It's been good. I mean, I had a session with Diana, which was very interesting. A novel, she talks about ordinary people, which I really enjoyed. The writing is really, really gorgeous. She's such a lyrical writer. So it was nice to sort of hear her talk about her process. It's like getting a behind the scenes. I always love her.
So how have you been since coming on Mostly Lit? What have you been up to?
What's been going on?
So a number of translations have come out since then. So I've been doing a bit of traveling to talk more and more and more about the book. And I had some time away on a residency at McDowell, which was just amazing. It was 6 weeks of just writing.
Do those things work for you? Do you find that they're helpful?
They're very helpful. I'm not sure that they work for everybody, but for me, it's just divine. I mean, I love going away on residencies. It's a great excuse to refuse to respond to any email.
I have sent Ray like, oh, there's this residency. I think that would be so peaceful, like just being in a huge house somewhere in the countryside, and no phone, no internet, just writing. Just being at
the
peace.
The first day I'll just be anxious.
I mean, the first few days are terrifying.
Because
it's like, you've been saying to yourself, you know, I'm not writing because I didn't have time. And then now you're here.
And you have the time.
And you're just like, okay, what if I can't write? The first few days are terrifying. And then you get used to it. And the other thing that's great about them is that there are all these brilliant people there too. Like they're writers, they're painters, and it can be very inspiring to listen to them. The ones that I've really loved, I've been mostly writers.
Writer residencies.
Because you have conversations that nobody is really interested in. I remember one where one of the writers, I think her boyfriend came and had dinner with us one night. And I think we had this very long discussion about adverbs. And, you know, I mean, that's where you can do stuff like this. And he was very passionate. And she was saying to her husband, this is what we do here.
Talking about adverbs. I like it.
You work all day and then you look forward to this discussion about adverbs this evening.
Okay, so now that we know you're going on writing residency.
What you writing?
It means that you're writing something. And if you can't give us everything, that's fine. We can go with minimum information. But it seems like something is in the process.
It is. So I'm working on a novel.
Okay.
Exclusive.
Yeah. It's a novel. It's got people in it.
Irons are not that
exclusive. Guys, we got really excited for a minute. It's fine.
What's it about? I feel like I'm still figuring it out. And the way I write, I start out thinking about one thing and then it just spirals. It becomes all these things. So it's a process of discovery. And right now with this book, I feel like I'm halfway through that process. I suppose right now it's a book about
the broadest
it's about life.
It's a book about people.
It's about people, it's about
and,
life.
And living.
Is it from the perspective of Nigerian people?
Yes.
Okay.
That I can tell you.
Yeah. It's a book same thing.
About Nigerians in Nigeria. I think it's a book that if I were to narrow it down right now, I feel like it's a book about Nigeria. In a way that, but I'm also reluctant to say that because Stay With Me started out very political. and then I sort of stripped it away. Mm. But this book feels like it will stay that way.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll see what happens.
I'm excited.
Yeah, we are excited.
Okay.
Yeah, so... All right, final thoughts then. But Michelle Obama is going to be releasing a book very soon, and then it's one of the most iconic.
Oh, I'm about to start it. I'm so
of
happy.
A generation, yeah. But so you're excited?
Yes. Really.
What does Michelle Obama mean to you?
Oh my god.
She can't speak.
I'm fangirling right now.
I'm actually dead.
I mean, like, if I ever met her, I would probably just collapse.
I was like, just thinking this. Yeah. This is me with Will Smith. No, Sterling K. Brown.
I was like, we want her on the show. Can you imagine?
Can you imagine? I think I'll just...
I'll retire.
I'll stand right... I'll evaporate.
Yeah, I would just collapse.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But what kind of stuff are you looking forward to most, like, within her story?
I just want to know how she does it. What does she mean to me? There's this moment when they were leaving the White House.
Yeah.
And...
Tiffany boxes, or is it the present part?
No, I think it was just the way she... She just did not have time for nonsense already. Like, she just did not have the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, when the new guys came in...
Yeah.
And Obama was still, like, being, the you know, very nice, very gracious, like, and gracious. And Michelle was just like, let's get out of here.
I really
just loved that.
Yeah.
That, and then, you know, they get to where was that? I think the Air Force base where they were going to take off.
Mm.
And you could see she was different. She was lively and she... And I really just respect that about her.
Yeah.
That she doesn't... And I understand, I mean, it's different personalities. She and her husband are very different people. But, you know, the fact that she was pleasant, but, you know, she really was just like, you know what, I'm done. You need to get on the plane, dude. Let's go.
But it's that typical black mom situation. It's like, all right, guys, we can have fun when we get to destination.
Let's go.
All of us, we don't have time for pleasantries. Like.
No, but she's just amazing.
Yeah.
She is amazing, and she is so... fully herself,
yeah.
And that's the sense I get of her, that she and I'm really curious about how she came into that, because it's not, I don't think it's as easy a thing to be as it appears,
yeah.
And particularly in that kind of very visible position,
yeah,
you know.
Okay, I just wanted to ask what can we be expecting from you outside of the novels, in terms of, like, moving forward the next year, the next 5 years? How have you developed as a writer, do you feel? And have you reached, I don't know, your writing destination goal?
I mean, I think the goal keeps evolving with each book.
Yeah.
Have I developed? I think so. I think I'm definitely a better writer now.
Ooh, okay, that's good to know. You can always get better.
Yeah.
I think I am.
Yeah.
Maybe solely because I cringe at everything I've done before now.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there's things I think, oh, that was good. And I'm thinking, there's other stuff I'm like, really, really, really. You know? So I think just that awareness is there more. And also because I've had the luxury of traveling and talking about the book and having the chance to just read a lot more than I ever did before. I mean, I always loved to read and I was always a big reader, but this past 1 year, I could really curate my reading in a very, very deliberate way. So, what should you expect?
Fun times.
I mean, another novel. And there's another project I'm working on.
Confidential.
Sort of. So, something coming.
All right. Cool.
Well, we'll see.
Amen.
Oh, we'll have you back on the show with
Oh,
the
yeah,
book.
Definitely.
You know what I mean?
I will be tweeting her.
And we will all be there.
Yeah.
None of this bitsy 75% thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Again.
It's been lovely.
Yeah.
Right. Catch you soon.
And you're amazing. That was hella fun. That was hilarious. I didn't even think I gave Alex time to say anything. I was so enamored.
I was proper like,
Yeah.
I was like, listen, you can have your time. And after that, we went out. Right, like,
and Alex is the only one who hasn't met her.
Yeah, I was just like,
well, you and I did an episode of Biobabble.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. I'm not. You don't care. Me and her, like, we literally, like, after that talk, we literally spoke for like an hour, 45 minutes, just ourselves. Just she was giving me so much writing advice. Mm-hmm. She's like, you know, hit me up.
She's like, what are you writing?
I will read anything you give me. Just send it over. Yeah. I'm so like, I love
the way she writes, where she's literally just like, it's a mess when she first writes it.
Yeah, and that's what she said to me.
Just to beat it into
shape. She's like, just write. It's going to be terrible.
Nah, she's really dope. She's really dope. She's walking.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Around, she was so chilled, like, you know what I mean. But then, yeah, we did speak to Diana Evans about her book Ordinary People, and she also spoke about how, you know, how what her writing process was, and it kind of like
how much work she
this
does,
whole weekend was about like beating us into shape about as writers, like telling us what we should and shouldn't be doing, and kind of emulating what they did. So, here's our little chat with Diana Evans. All right, we have Diane Evans here. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. How are you finding the festival?
It's great. Yeah, I've just done a wonderful event with Alex Park and Ayobami as well.
What did you guys talk about on the panel?
We talked about our books, Stay With Me and Ordinary People, and ideas of motherhood and Nigerian writing, Black British writing, the supernatural. We talked about authorship and novels and why we write novels. It's a really interesting discussion.
Could you give us a background about the book and about what it's about, and just for listeners to try and get an idea of where you're coming from?
Yeah, Ordinary People is a novel about two couples, and it's set in London, and it's about the relationships between the couples over 1 year, which is the year in which Barack Obama was elected president in 2008, and then it also includes the death of Michael Jackson, and it really just dissects the two different relationships. One is impacted by the birth of a new child and how that creates imbalance and friction between the man and the woman, and then the other is impacted by the death of a parent, and it talks about how that impacts on marriage as well.
And where did the idea of the book come from? Was it just based on off of the events of 2008, or were there other things that stimulated and became the emphasis of the story?
There are so many things that inspire this story. I wanted to write a certain kind of book that was about contemporary Black Londoners and their everyday ordinary lives, and also wanted to write a portrait of London and Black Londoners within that portrait. But I wanted to write about smaller domestic things as well, such as motherhood and death and bereavement and relationships between men and women. So I also wanted to write about I always tend to include some element of the supernatural in my novel.
Yeah.
Well, so that comes into the motherhood theme around the change of identity in a woman when she has a child, yeah, and the impact on her identity and this idea of two selves.
Yeah.
And that is dealt with in a supernatural way in the book.
What was the hardest thing, I guess, on your end with regards to the writing structure and how you managed one to write a book? Because I think that's a massive feat. Because I mean, both Alex and I are writers, but I'm always struggling with, okay, like I finally got 5,000 words today, guys. So how did you keep that momentum, and how did you structure yourself and discipline yourself so that you could get to the final end?
Well, I always take a very regimental approach, yeah, to writing when I'm working on a novel. That's the only way I can do it. You have to have a routine, structured routine in, yeah, place. I have to write 5 days a week, and I have to write about 1,000 words a day, a minimum of 600 words a day. That's a bad day. 1,000 words is a good day. And I have to achieve those word counts every day, because that's how you maintain a sense of momentum. Yeah. Momentum is really important to amassing the word count of a, yeah, novel. You just have to keep going.
Yeah.
But it does take a long time. It always takes a long time for me. The structure is always the most difficult thing,
yeah,
for me.
When you say 1,000 words a, yeah, day, does that just pure writing of 1,000 words, or do you ever like look over what you wrote yesterday, edit that, and does that include the 1,000 words?
No, it's new, fresh words.
New, fresh,
yeah,
words.
But that's in the drafting stage. When I'm editing, it's slightly different. I don't really have a word count to work with, yeah, when I'm editing.
Yeah.
But when I'm drafting, just getting the words out on the page, it has to be 1,000 fresh words.
Yeah. Yeah.
But before I start that, I might, you know, go over what I wrote yesterday and just so that there's a sense of continuity, yeah, in the writing.
Right, okay. Yeah.
What do you want somebody who has finished reading Ordinary People to come out thinking and come out feeling? Very loaded question.
Well, I think with all my books, I want people to come out feeling a connection with the characters, mm, and that they've been on a journey with the characters, and you know, they've sort of got to know them. And and I'd also like the reader to feel a real deep understanding of the different psychologies of the men and the women in the book, because it was very important to me that I explored those psychologies on an equal footing. So I go quite intensely into the male and female minds. I'd like the reader to come away with that sense of empathy with both sides of the story.
Nice. Oh wait, we have a final question to ask. So we have, well, I mean, everyone knows now it's out, but so Michelle Obama has a book coming out later this year.
Yeah.
Cool. Two questions. What does Michelle Obama mean to you, or mean to, I guess, black women? And what was our next question that we were supposed to ask? After we were supposed to.
Just around, I guess, if you've heard about the book and if you're interested in reading it.
Michelle Obama's book?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're interested in reading it, what is it that you...
It's a biography. Her autobiography. I like Michelle Obama because she has this incredible power, but incredible warmth and intimacy at the same time, and she seems to have managed to maintain a sense of who she is through her marriage and her power and her status, and she seems to be full of goodness. I love that about her.
All right, good. Well, thank you so much, Diana, for speaking to us.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Diana Evans. So yeah. 600 words minimum she does
each day. Each day. Yeah.
But she does 1,000 when she's in the writing phase.
Crazy.
I remember I tried that once. I tried to do 1,000 a day.
I tried to do 1,000 a day before work. It's really hard.
Before?
Yeah, because I'm a morning person.
I tried to do it 600. and that kind of.
Fuck, yeah. I can't work in the evenings.
Trying to do 500 in the morning, 500 in the evening.
Mm. Oh, I can't work in the evenings.
But when I'm vibing, I could write like what 5,000 in the day. I think the most I've ever done is 10,000 in a day.
Mm.
But I was just in the zone.
That was so tiring.
Yeah, it was mad. But then I read it back and I was like, this is trash. I had to throw it away.
That's the thing, like, it's just so important just to write and then not edit as you write, because that just becomes...
Apparently you shouldn't do that.
Yeah, I know.
I was stuck on this one chapter for months. Every time I'd be like, okay, I'm going to start something new today, like continue writing. Mm. But instead of just continuing where I've left off, I'll start from the beginning just to see where I'm at.
Mm-hmm.
Before you know it, I'm editing everything. Yeah. And 2 hours have passed and I'm like, oh great, nothing's done.
I used to do it as a guy. When I was younger, I used to buy all these little books on how to write a novel and all that. And it was like, they always said, don't edit as you write. Yeah. It just hold you up. So who do we have next?
So now we spoke to the amazing Laura Freeman. She spoke to us about her latest novel, The Reading Cure, How Books Restored My Appetite. It literally says what it's about on the cover. So essentially, Laura talks about how reading helped her overcome anorexia. And we just spoke a lot around that in other books that have helped us. And I guess the purpose of books in a way. So this is what Laura had to say.
How was the panel, Laura?
It was excellent, and I think one of the pleasures of doing these events, you're an author, you spend a lot of time on your own, but then you come here and you meet fellow authors. I met Matt Haig and Ashley Young and Scarlett Curtis, who is comparing, and it's just fascinating to share all your sort of authorly neuroses in the green room beforehand, and then to chat about books on stage.
Does it kind of feel like, you know, some people say, when you're not at work, don't talk about work. And then you're a writer, then you meet writers, then you talk about writing. Does it ever get too much? Do you ever think, okay, I don't want to talk about writing today?
No, I think you're desperate for it, because actually if you sit alone in your spare room, as I do all day by yourself, you're kind of chomping at the bit to talk to others. My partner sometimes says when he gets home from the office, he'll look at me and go, you've got that expression on your face. And I'll say, oh, what expression? And he says, it's the I've not talked to another human being all day expression.
Oh, okay.
And you do get like that. And so it is really joyous to come here and sort of swap notes.
Yeah.
What was it about today that you, I guess, learned, or what are some tips that you got from different writers that you've spoken to throughout the last couple of days and today?
I think our panel was all about books and mental health and the books that helped us. And I think what was fascinating is actually how so many different sorts of books, from memoir to self-help to novels to poems to books of quotations, had in different ways for different people, you know, been incredibly comforting, had offered solace. And I think sometimes you can get into this mindset and you think, well, the only way to get myself better is to read a sort of 10-point self-help book. And actually there are all sorts of different ways that literature can be inspiring.
Definitely. Well, do you want to tell us a bit about what your book's about?
So my book is called The Reading Cure, How Books Restored My Appetite.
Very interesting title.
Yeah, I think it sort of speaks to the Cheltenham goer. And really, it's a memoir of having been very ill with anorexia as a teenager. But really, it's about recovery, and it's about the books I read as I was getting better.
Mm.
Particularly about reading wonderful and very appetizing, tempting descriptions of food on the page, and that kind of giving me the courage to try them in real life.
What is, I guess, so I find that whenever I go and read books to get better, I all of a sudden, I always align books with this medicinal therapy. And I guess what always tends to happen to me is when I'm feeling okay, I go to books and all of a sudden I'm back in that melee and that downtrodden. So how do you ensure that you're not only reading books just for the sake of, I guess, getting better, because then you might start looking at books as medicine in a way?
I think I was very lucky in a strange roundabout way not to have done an English literature degree, which lots of writers will have done at university. Because I think lots of people get really ground down by kind of doing theory and sort of beginning to read books only in an analytical way. And because I did history of art, actually when I come to books, it's not as a scholar, it's not as an academic, it's just as a reader. So books never have for me that sense of obligation or grind or pressure. It's just escapism. Although curiously I had the opposite thing, which was by the end of my degree I never wanted to see a painting again, and it took me about 5 years to kind of want to go to a gallery.
So for example, when I'm feeling like low or something and I think to myself, okay, let me read a book that's going to pick me up. Sometimes a book just makes me feel worse. Did you ever pick up a book and think, this book may help me, and then it just literally had the reverse effect?
We were talking about this a little bit on the panel, and sort of books that we talk about trigger warnings today, you know, were there books that were triggering for us? I think I don't really enjoy books about young women having a terrible time that sort of end in sort of despair. And we're talking about Sylvia Plath. I find her rather difficult to kind of cope with. I think some of the Edith Wharton heroines, you know, who have these sort of terrible, long, long, sad declines and ending in sort of death.
Really despise those books.
Thomas Hardy women.
I mean, I love Thomas Hardy, but I remember reading Tess. I was like, it's going to have a happy ending. It's going to have a happy ending. And until about five pages before the end, I thought she's going to survive. And sadly, spoiler alert, but
I mean, she named her child sorrow.
Yes.
And then the child died a few days later. Oh, God, it was
she's just a bit relentless. And I suppose you then maybe have to read Far From the Madding Crowd, which actually does. And in a slightly more uplifting way.
But not Jude the Obscure.
No, I don't think I can stomach that.
So what books in particular would you say helped you in terms of fiction?
In terms of fiction, I loved Dickens. I think because he creates this whole massive world and you get so lost in it, you know, in his sort of labyrinth of London streets. And sometimes people say to me, well, it's very odd for a former anorexic to be excited by Dickens because, you know, he does big, heavy, masculine meals, you know, pork pies and all the rest of it. And actually, for me, it was the way that food was often just really incidental as part of the plot. And it just explained to me that food was just part of life. It wasn't an enemy. It wasn't something to be fought. It wasn't something to be fearful of. It was actually, you know, you ate haystacks of buttered toast as ballast for an adventure. And I think that was immensely appealing.
So what are some of the books that you guys actually, when you think about food, what are the ones that you think about the most?
Haruki Murakami. He's always writing about food. He describes it so well. Literally every single, it's like a book sometimes. Murakami. And Down and Out in London and Paris.
Oh, I've not read that one yet.
Although
actually,
it's really strange, because obviously it's about George Orwell being on the streets.
Yeah.
Because he's so hungry, and he puts an emphasis on the fact that when you're starving and homeless, you think about food non-stop. When he describes him just eating things like bread and butter and beans, it's so delicious that for a week afterwards, I was eating bread, butter and beans. Do you know what I mean? So that don't come from mind, definitely.
I do think that one was Harry Potter, though, wasn't it?
Because it's like the Christmas meal,
even like the entrance to the Great Hall or whatever, like it was always about all this food that they're gonna have, the treacle tarts and all that.
I think the tuck trolley on the Hogwarts Express, chocolate frogs and pumpkin pasties.
From the very beginning, it just makes you wonder what kind of foods they had in that world and all these different things.
I think for me it was Great Expectations. Dickens,
Christmas Carol as well, because there was that. I feel there's a scene in there
with a feast.
With the feast and stuff. You know, when it's like Christmas present.
So what was it in Great Expectations?
It was
set you off.
It was not having the food when Pip was still like in the Shires, I'd say, and then when he goes into the city, or when he—I don't know if he ate a lot when he went to see Estella and Havisham. I remember that they just used to play cards, but I know that there was a deprivation of food, and then there was a lot of food, so that made me quite notice the food in Dickens as well.
And that's one really thing that Dickens does and that stuck with me, is a lot of his more malevolent characters withhold food. You know, the poor Oliver Twist is starved by the workhouse, and whereas his more benign characters, they feed, they host, they're generous, they're welcoming, and that set up for me this whole idea that food was a really positive thing, and it hadn't been that for me for a long time.
I don't know if you want to talk about this, but what were the kind of triggers that kind of led you into that? Was it something that you saw? Was it television?
I think the origins of these things are always multiple. I had been very unhappy at my school. It was a very academic place, huge pressure to do well. I think it was not terribly sisterly school, despite being an all-girls school. Very competitive. And I think I was probably quite a shy, introspective child, and it was just a bit of a sort of brutal environment, and perhaps in a smaller school I might have done better. And I think sometimes anorexia comes about because you can't control your external environment. I couldn't do anything about the school. So you focus on something you can control.
Yeah.
And in my case, that was food. And it became more and more restricted and unfortunately spiraled into illness.
I want to... So you touched on trigger warnings earlier. earlier, I wanted to ask you how you feel about that, because some people say they're good and people should be told when something could potentially trigger them, but then others say we're kind of like money-coddling people and we're not exposing them to things that they need to get over. I wanted to know how you feel about it.
I think I'm probably with the mollycoddle argument in that I think life is full of sad, distressing, tough things, and what literature does is help us understand them and come to terms with them and face them more bravely. I think I do find it hard reading descriptions of starvation or hunger, but I think in some ways it makes you stronger to read them and to be able to grapple with them. And I think trying to kind of create a safety net, trying to protect yourself, actually doesn't make you stronger, it makes you weaker.
But doesn't, for example, too much of this almost desensitize you, and then you end up walking into horrific situations or horrific texts with the same air as you would if nothing else, nothing wrong was happening? My only issue is I get the money coddling, but too much of it will just make it like anything else, and we still need to understand that horrible things are still horrible.
I think that's absolutely true. I think most people probably have a sense. I mean, if you're going to read a tragedy by Shakespeare, I think you might have to brace yourself that someone's going to be killed, and they might be killed in a gory way, and it might be sad. I think it's true that sometimes you can read a novel and you're slightly ambushed. I think you don't expect a particularly horrible, visceral, grisly scene.
Or even a film.
Or maybe a film, and I think maybe sometimes that's where it comes into it. I remember being distressed seeing the film Requiem for a Dream.
Oh, yeah.
And that's something I wish I could unwatch. I really wish I had never seen it.
I mean, it was Bridge to Terabithia. I watched it on the plane. I remember thinking, this is going to be great. And then the character dies, and I just... Oh.
Yeah.
But I still think... I suppose sometimes it gets... It's a way of teaching you where your limits are and what you're prepared to tolerate and what sort of art you want to partake in.
Yeah.
And I know now I don't want to watch films about drug addiction and sexual abuse.
So, how is your relationship with food now? You're smiling now. When you see a huge plate, do you just like, oh my God?
It's a great deal more positive than it was. Yeah. I eat very widely. I think I'm very lucky that I'm going to be married to a man who's got a sort of invincible appetite. I think he's been a very positive influence on me. And he has this lovely phrase, which is, if you ever say, do you want seconds? He goes, go on then.
Yeah.
And I think, oh, go on then, is such a lovely idea, whether it's for seconds or thirds, or whether it's just for life. You know, are you a bit scared of doing something? Oh, go on then, I'll do it anyway. And I think I enjoy food. I take pleasure in cooking. And I'm well in a way... I never hoped or expected to be.
Well, we're going to have to round up there. Thank you so much for talking to us. Thank you so much for talking to us. So yeah, that was an interesting chat. So we're coming to the end of this, but we managed to speak to writer, journalist and activist Scarlett Curtis about her new book, Feminists Don't Wear Pink and Other Lies.
It's a book that features a range of incredible women such as Adwa Aboah and Akila Hughes on what the F word means to them.
What's the F word?
Feminism.
Family.
So it's a dirty word now.
Friends.
Apparently.
So this is her interview. Hi. We're speaking to Scarlett Curtis.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
We're good. How are you finding the festival?
I'm loving it. It's really interesting. I think I was here last year as well, and already this year feels really different. I always love it, but there's a lot of young people here now and a lot of like feminist events and more kind of diverse events, and I'm really loving it.
So when you came last year, how was it different? Because obviously now your book is out.
Yes.
So last year, what was it like compared to this one?
So last year, I was literally here as a Hillary Clinton fangirl.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. I flew back from New York basically just to see her and cried the whole time and then bought the same pantsuit that she was wearing
interview.
But yeah, it's really weird. It's really surreal to be here kind of with an actual book instead of just fanning all over other people with books.
Yeah.
What was it like doing that panel with your mum and your dad all together? Because that must have been a huge hike.
Yeah, it was pretty scary. My mum, she wasn't on stage, she was in the audience, but I could hear her. It was quite funny because I could hear her laughing at things no one else was laughing at. Yeah. Because like she just got that it was funny. I was good. I was really nervous. And I think because I felt like I didn't want the audience to feel like they hadn't like got the interview they wanted, like I didn't want them to be like, what was the point in that, we just saw a father and daughter chatting for an hour. But it was good, and I felt like I always like tease my dad a bit about things that I think he's not good at, and it was fun to like be able to chat about that. Yeah.
So feminists don't wear pink.
Yes,
tell us about it.
So the book's called Feminists Don't Wear Pink and Other Lies. I keep getting these tweets that are like, oh, your book's called Feminists Don't Wear Pink and you've got pink hair? Like, it's so stupid.
That makes sense.
Did you not even read the title? I'm like, read the whole title? Like, it's one sentence.
Yeah.
It is a collection of essays by 52 young women on what feminism means to them. All the royalties are going to this amazing charity called Girl Up. And we've actually got loads, four of the Girl Up girls that have written essays for the book, which are some of my favourite pieces in the book. And I think I've been working for the last like 4 years in kind of feminist activism and different activist causes, and I really just wanted, it feels like the feminist movement now is entering this really incredible new phase, and I really wanted to create something that just captured all of that. It's definitely not like a how to be a feminist guide or kind of a history of the movement. It's much more like how people feel about it and why you might want to get involved.
And how was it managing that many writers and putting this body of work together?
Yeah, it was very stressful. Also, it's like hard because all the like so many people we ask are activists that are like, you know, working tirelessly. Like, you know, Nimco was in Somaliland, like Elish Gaz was somewhere else. And then you feel really bad being like, remember that essay that I asked you to write? Like, you're actually behind deadline.
Yeah.
I know that you're like ending FGM, but it would be really great if you sent it. But no, everyone filed really late. And everyone, me and my editor were kind of pretending everyone had sent in their piece. And be like, yeah, we've got the manuscript, it's great.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't until the last day that we like actually had it all together. But it was amazing and it was really fun. And everyone, something that was really interesting about asking people to do it was everyone, you know, the book's called Feminists Don't Wear Pink and Other Lies, and it's kind of about the lies you've been told about what it means to be a feminist. And like on the cover, it's like silly lies, like wear pink, have fun, wear makeup. But everyone we asked through the book would email back and say, I don't think I know enough about feminism to write about this. And this is even like people that have dedicated their lives to, you know, issues to do with women and girls. And I think to me that emerged as the biggest lie that we've been told, is that you almost need like a degree to be a feminist or to have read all these books or have done all these protests or, you know, whatever. Yeah. And actually, we've really lost that idea that all you need to do is believe men and women should be equal.
Yeah.
And like, that's it. And then you can learn and you can relearn and you can educate yourself. But I think that was really interesting.
Yeah.
Good. So was there a particular goal you had for the book, or was it just to raise money for Girl Up?
I think, yeah, it's like twofold, because it's raising money for Girl Up, who are helping with like the huge issues like child marriage, girls and education, you know, big, big global things. And I think the other thing was just, if anyone reads it who maybe didn't think they're a feminist and then realises that it's something they want to get involved with, especially like I'm really obsessed with teenage girls and like young girls and the force of young girls. And I think if you can discover this when you're 13, 14, 15, that's a lifetime of like fighting for women's issues that might be ahead of you. So even if like two people read it and change their mind, that would be the goal.
Has this inspired you to write anything else or anything more?
A bit more fiction.
Like more fiction, young adult stuff.
I would love to do that. I think one of the reasons I made this an anthology, you know, I've been working as a journalist for like 7 years now and done various little things, but I think I so don't feel ready. I didn't, when I started this, feel ready to like do something all myself. And I think just because you're offered something doesn't mean you should necessarily ask, especially if you're like from privilege or, you know, have the family connections that I have or whatever.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to make sure I didn't rush it, but I think I would love in the future to try and write something more.
We look forward to reading it.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Carla, for joining us. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So this is it, guys. We had such a great time at the festival. Hope you all enjoyed these behind-the-scenes chats, and we really can't wait to bring you more fun content like this. We had such a great time at the festival, and we hope to go again soon.
No, it was lit.
Yeah.
Especially Lenny Henry. Man like Lenny.
Shout out to Lenny.
Yeah.
Sir Lenny.
Sir Lenny Hen. Sir no. Lenny Len.
Sir like Lenny Len. On the Henny.
Lenny on the Henny.
Man like
Lenny
Mr. on Henry.
The Henny. Lenny Len. Lenny, Lenny, Lenny,
Lenny. Lenny on
Len.
The Henny.
It was so weird sitting next to him because I used to watch, I think it was his first show called Chef.
Oh.
Do you ever see it?
No, I never saw it.
I wasn't born.
You weren't born?
Possibly.
Probably not.
You were born, just not.
But anyway, just Chef. And then obviously everyone knows the Lenny Henry show.
Yeah.
I didn't.
So it was really surreal. I was trying my best. I was trying not to fanboy. I was just trying to do that. Yeah, bro.
Lenny, I wanted to ask him about his character. Yeah. Like, you know that. Do you remember Lenny Henry show?
Yeah, of course. When
he was the old Jamaican man and he loved Mrs. Johnson.
Of course.
I wanted to ask him about that.
Of course.
I never got to ask
Mrs. Johnson.
Him. Mrs. Johnson. Mrs. Johnson. He's probably disturbing her life. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, but guys, please make sure you rate, review, and subscribe to Mostly Lit on all the relevant channels because it's really important to us. Helps us get out there. We can talk to more people, get more people reading, get more people engaged, more people of color, more mandem.
More black people.
Get me more black people. Get me the Muslimics. We're trying to talk to everybody. We out here. Please rate, review, and subscribe.
Meanwhile, if you want to re-listen back to this show we did with Lenny Henry, make sure you listen back to the Cheltenham episode with him. That's our final thoughts.
That's that.
Catch you guys next time.
Thanks for listening.
See
you next time.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.